Now, shall we begin?
Just keep in mind that, you know, we've allowed our government to get rid of habeas corpus. We've allowed our government to have a complete 24-hour complete surveillance state, right? Which that's the opposite of liberty. That's the opposite of freedom. And the people were warned when they did this. Like, yeah, it's okay because everybody likes Barack Obama right now. But what happens if there's the next president? And nobody predicted Trump then, but here we are. Mm-hmm. So if this does happen, it's a real loud call to the we need to take back control of our and get back to our values as Americans. We need to have the Constitution matter again. Right now, we've been letting the government do all kinds of unconstitutional shit.
We begin, as we often do, with Lenin's maxim that in politics, the only question that matters is who does what to whom. The what always remains constant. It is the exercise of government power without limit, resting directly on force, unrestrained by laws. The who and the whom will change, but the what is eternal. And the polarity shift that occurred on Tuesday, which has not been fully realized, Donald Trump will not actually be elected president until December 19th, and suddenly a lot of people who consider the Electoral College to be an anti-democratic archaism from the 18th century are rediscovering the virtues of that constitutional provision, which would allow electors to vote for a more qualified personage if that met the demands of their conscience. And he will not be inaugurated president until the 20th of January, but nonetheless, the cultural dials have been reset, and the who-whom polarity has shifted. This means that the left, at least some people within the left who retain the capacity for actual sapience, will be introduced to the idea that government is something other than a benign enterprise, at least when its power is being directed at them or people they care about. And people on the right, or what I call the other left, given their philosophical inclinations, will begin sermonizing on the imperative necessity of all Americans supporting the personage they will refer to as our president, as if he were the embodiment of the general will. That's something that Milwaukee Sheriff David Clark has actually said. David Clark is most likely going to be on the short list to become the Commissar of Homeland Security under a Trump regime. These temper tantrums from these radical anarchists must be quelled, wrote Clark. There is no legitimate reason to protest the will of the people, which is supposedly embodied in Donald Trump. And that is a concept derived directly from Jean-Jacques Rousseau's The Social Contract, which was the doctrine of the Jacobins and has been the doctrine of their descendants through the 19th and 20th centuries. That's essentially where Leninism comes from. He embodies the will of the people. Well, no, the President of the United States, under the Constitution, is somebody who presides over one branch of one of the many governments in a confederated republic. Unless you are an employee of the executive branch or a member of the United States military, once it's been activated by the Congress, you do not have a president unless you choose to have a president. Since 1991, I've made it a point of saying that the occupant of the Oval Office doesn't preside over me in any way that I see fit to recognize. 1991, of course, represents the beginning of what is now the open-ended and apparently interminable war in Iraq. Until that time, I was probably a standard-issue, somewhat Reaganite conservative. Beginning in late 1990, when it was clear that we were going to be involved in a war that had nothing to do with the national interests of the United States, reasonably defined, let alone the defense of the persons and property of the citizens of the United States, I began to reevaluate some of my premises. And by the middle of 1991, I'd come to the conclusion that whoever is presiding over the federal executive branch is most likely going to be a criminal and probably a murderer. And so I decided from that point that whoever that official was, he certainly did not represent me, and he most certainly did not preside over me. And that was the perspective I had with the election of Bill Clinton in 1992, and I've retained it ever since. Too many other people, however, seem to have lives that are so sterile that they are meaningless unless they are validated in some way by the election of a president who supposedly represents them. And we're seeing, of course, a continent-spanning conniption fit by people, most of them of college age, either chronologically or at least intellectually, who meet that description. they find their lives blighted by the absence or the impending absence of someone in the White House who would represent their faction, on the assumption, once again, that they will always be the who and never be the whom. Somebody once said that every ruler builds a house that another will inherit. My adaptation of that maxim is that every ruler expands the architecture of oppression, which enhances the prison in which his subjects and their children will live. And this is especially true of rulers who supposedly have a democratic mandate to exercise violence on behalf of a collective. In other words, somebody who represents or embodies the will of the people. During the campaign, at most of Donald Trump's rallies in August, September, and right up to Election Day, the crowd would lustily chant, "Lock her up," referring, of course, to Hillary Clinton and her admitted criminal conduct with respect to the diversion of classified State Department emails and other intelligence and military communications to a non-secured private server. And more importantly, I suppose, the fact that she lied to the FBI about her behavior, which is an offense for which many, many people, including Martha Stewart, who have done more productive things with their lives than Hillary Clinton ever did, have been sent to prison. On many occasions, they've been sent to prison not because they lied to the FBI, but because the FBI transcribed the interview in a way that contradicted what the person actually said. And the FBI's 302 report of that conversation was taken as definitive, but I digress. They were chanting, "Lock her up," and they represent the sort of American who believes that our country is under-policed and that our prisons are underpopulated. And of course, they're wrong on both fronts. But I believe that the leitmotif of the Trump administration is going to be the type of law and order conceit that sees the role of the executive branch as almost entirely punitive. I don't see anything in Trump's platform, his associations, or his constituency that embraces the idea that government is too big and too invasive. They see government as being in the hands of the wrong people. They see government as being presided over by people who are too weak in the exercise of the powers of the office. And they pretend to see the necessity of expanding what is already the largest, most powerful, most expensive, and most invasive government in the history of mankind. At some point, I'm hoping for at least some part of that subpopulation that had been chanting "lock her up," the fever is going to break, and they will recover some capacity for reflective thought. At that point, they should consider a parable found in the prison memoir of Armando Valladares, who is a Cuban political dissident who spent 22 years in Fidel Castro's gulag. For most of the time, he was confined in the model prison on the Isla de Pinos. It was constructed in the 1930s under the reign of military dictator Gerardo Machado. It was immense, much bigger than any reasonable need would dictate. Cuba at the time was not overrun by violent criminals. After the prison plans were approved and as construction began, one of General Machado's advisors approached him and asked why he was building such an extravagantly large prison, which was obviously several times the size that any need would dictate. Machado blithely replied, according to Valladares, "Don't you worry. Somebody will come along who'll manage to fill it up." That somebody, Valladares grimly wrote, was Fidel Castro. Every U.S. president sees himself as the winner of a mandate to expand the powers of his office. That was true when Bill Clinton inherited the office from George H.W. Bush. It was certainly true after George H.W. Bush's son was handed off the presidency from Bill Clinton, and under the reign of George W. Bush, the federal government's powers, particularly in the executive branch, became distended beyond any recognition. Barack Obama inherited that office from George W. Bush and retained every salient feature of the Homeland Security state and created precedents in the exercise of executive power that did alarm many principled civil libertarians on the left. And now that office is inherited by Donald Trump. Donald Trump's unique contribution to the formula for executive despotism is the idea of personal rule. Recall that during the convention, when he accepted the nomination for the United States presidency, Donald Trump talked about what he would do. "I alone can fix the problems in Washington," and his besotted followers chanted in unison, "Yes, you will. Yes, you will." you're seeing, for the first time perhaps in historical memory, a president who literally sees himself as the embodiment of the collective will. And that dreadful development will give Americans of all varieties much cause for lamentation in the years to come. I will have a great deal more to say about this after the break. This is Will Grigg with Freedom Zealot Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. Please stand by for more sedition after this.
Obama did not make torture illegal. So here's what I mean by that. If he had prosecuted people who had done the torture, then it would have been clear that it is illegal and we're not allowed to do it. Instead, he said, we won't do it anymore.
He stopped.
He
stopped.
Go forward, not go back.
He stopped torturing people.
Which was his word.
And we let everybody off the hook.
Which makes it a political decision and a policy decision as opposed to a legal decision.
When Donald Trump becomes commander-in-chief in January, he will take on presidential powers that have never been more expansive and unchecked, warns Alex Emmons in The Intercept. He'll control an unaccountable drone program and the prison at Guantanamo Bay, which, incidentally, he wants to expand. His FBI, and I think the proprietary pronoun there makes sense, Donald Trump and Rudy Giuliani, his likely chief commissar or chief procurator at the Justice Department, are very tightly wired into the FBI's New York office. His FBI, including a network of 15,000 paid informants, already has a record of spying on mosques and activists, and his NSA's surveillance empire is ubiquitous and governed by arcane rules, most of which remain secret. He will inherit bombing campaigns in seven Muslim countries, the de facto ability to declare war unilaterally, and a massive nuclear arsenal, much of which is on hair trigger alert. I should point out that in his foreign policy speech several months ago, Donald Trump explicitly said that drone strikes will remain part of his counterterrorism program. Caught off guard by Hillary Clinton's election defeat, Democrats who defended these powers under President Obama may suddenly be having second thoughts as the White House gets handed over to a man they described with good reason as unhinged and dangerously unfit. In the years after the 9/11 terror attacks, Vice President Dick Cheney, who supported Trump, by the way, for those of you who think that Donald Trump is dramatically different from and opposed to the neocon faction in the Republican Party, there is nobody more emblematic of the neocons than Dick Cheney. Vice President Dick Cheney and his legal advisor David Addington dramatically expanded the powers of the presidency, asserting the unilateral right in wartime to ignore legal limits on things like torture and government eavesdropping. Congressional Democrats generally caved, but made a few efforts to push back. The Democrats went silent on executive overreach when Obama was elected, however, just as the anti-war left disappeared entirely. When the New York Times revealed Bush's warrantless wiretap program in 2005, 60% of registered Democrats thought the program was unacceptable. But after NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden revealed a dramatically larger surveillance apparatus in 2013, 61% of Democrats said the opposite, presumably because they trusted the man in charge. Once again, who does what to whom? is the operative principle. The Obama administration has counted on that trust repeatedly. When defending the drone program in 2012, instead of referencing its legal standards, administration officials reassured the New York Times that Obama is a student of the writings on war by Augustine and Thomas Aquinas. If that were true, by the way, he would behave much differently. And that CIA Director John Brennan is like a priest with extremely strong moral values who was suddenly charged with leading a war. After 8 years of trusting the president with expanding military power, liberals must now reckon with the fact that Obama will pass the same capabilities to a man who has proposed killing terrorists' innocent family members, which is something Obama has done. He killed the entirely innocent 16-year-old son of a U.S. citizen, and the son himself was a native-born U.S. citizen. The son was killed because the father was branded an enemy of the state, but never convicted of a criminal offense. It was corruption of blood, if you will, as the basis for an executive-ordered summary execution by drone strike. Liberals must now reckon with the fact that Obama will pass the same capabilities to a man who has proposed killing terrorists' innocent family members, who has said he would do a hell of a lot worse than waterboarding, and who has suggested dipping bullets in pig's blood is sound counterterrorism strategy. And most of the paltry few legal limitations that regulate the security state could easily be repealed by a President Trump. In 2015, for instance, in response to protests in Ferguson, Missouri, Obama signed an order banning the transfers of certain surplus military weapons to police, including armored vehicles, grenade launchers, bayonets, and high-caliber ammunition. These are very modest restrictions, I should point out, that are placed on the Pentagon's 1033 program, which has its origins in the Nixon administration, but became a formal policy of the Justice Department and the Defense Department in 1995 under the Clinton administration. It was Janet Reno, who just this past week paid her debt to her maker, who signed the operational orders that put the 1033 transfer program into motion. After Obama signed this order in 2015, placing some minor and trivial restrictions on the 1033 program, Trump, who has called the police the most mistreated people in America and has refused to criticize police for brutality or killings, could easily revoke that ban. I would expect that that would be one of the first things he would do. Trump said he would create a deportation force, apparently ignorant of the fact that he'll inherit one. Obama has increased the budget for immigration enforcement to an all-time high and accelerated the rate of deportations. Obama has deported more than 2.5 million people, already more than any other president, and has made the Department of Homeland Security the largest law enforcement agency in the country, and he is derided by the Trumpians as being too weak and excessively zealous for civil liberties and an enemy of law enforcement. Obama has been a militarist, and he has been a friend of the Homeland Security state, notwithstanding the caricature that is being put forth by the putative populists. To continue now with the Intercept article, Obama also already incarcerates hundreds of thousands of immigrants in detention centers and forces young children to appear before immigration judges without a lawyer. Trump will also take over the FBI, which has 35,000 employees and a network of 15,000 paid informants. Trump, who has said Muslim Americans should be forced to register on a government list, could easily rewrite its investigative guidelines or have somebody do it for him. Don't for a second believe that Trump would immerse himself in these details. As a matter of fact, I think by midterm he's going to be so bored by the presidency that he will have subcontracted almost all of it to Mike Pence, much the same way that George W. Bush farmed out all the details to Dick Cheney. As for the NSA, Congress passed a law in 2015 ending the bulk collection of Americans' phone records and replaced it with a modified program, but according to a former State Department official, the phone records program is minuscule compared to the government's universe of collection under Executive Order 12333, which Trump is free to reinterpret or modify. To make matters worse, the Obama administration has convinced courts that citizens cannot challenge the legality of NSA programs until they can prove that they are under surveillance. Because government secrecy makes that generally impossible, courts have started to reject anti-surveillance lawsuits on procedural grounds. Trump may also get his wish to fill up Guantanamo Bay. Despite Obama's efforts this year to rapidly depopulate the prison camp, 60 prisoners remain, along with the architecture to imprison hundreds more. Guantanamo Bay, of course, like Isla de Pinos, is in Cuba. Whenever the government builds a prison, it'll find a way to fill it up. I'll be back in just a minute. Donald Trump's self-identified libertarian supporters have been warning him against the prospect of a neoconservative counter-revolution, which I think has already taken place or is underway. If you take a look at the personalities who compose his transition team, there are two celebrity pseudo-libertarians who are members of the transition team. I don't think that an authentic libertarian would be seeking a role in shaping the executive branch of the federal Leviathan. It must be understood that neoconservatism is not the only variety of aggressive statism upon which Donald Trump could draw in accentuating federal executive tyranny. There is also a certain strain of religious conservatism, and it should be remembered that Donald Trump has a Sanhedrin of evangelical pastors who advised him. And one of his most politically profitable promises was that he would overturn the Johnson Amendment with respect to the political involvement, partisan political involvement, of churches and other religious communities. It's amazing how little it takes to buy these people off. Kevin Cramer, who is the congressman at large afflicting the state of North Dakota, sent a letter to four heads of broadcast networks on November 4th. Which illustrates the kinship, once again, between the contemporary religious right and the progressivist left of a century ago. And that kinship reflects the fact that the contemporary religious right is the lineal descendant of the progressive movement. "Dear Mr. Sherwood, Mr. Burke, Mr. Moonves, and Ms. Walden," begins this letter, "as a member of the House Committee on Energy and Commerce with subcommittee assignments on communications and technology, and oversight and investigations, I am writing to inform you that I intend to request a hearing to explore network media bias in coverage of the 2016 presidential campaign. A recent Gallup poll indicates that Americans' trust and confidence in the mass media to report the news fully, accurately, and fairly has dropped to 32%, its lowest level in polling history. That being the case, Kevin, why are hearings necessary? The public understands that they're being lied to. They don't need your intervention." Last week, a poll released by the Associated Press also found that 56% of likely voters think the media is biased against Republican nominee Donald Trump, while just 37% say the coverage of the race is mostly balanced. Again, that is a data point reflecting the fact that people are able to exercise some element of discernment in terms of what they're being told by the mass media. And this is another illustration of the complete lack of necessity of some kind of corrective intervention by government, as if government ever corrects anything by intervening rather than exacerbating problems. To continue. "Furthermore, a Harvard University study this summer reported that Donald Trump coverage went from 57% positive and 43% negative during the early Republican primaries to 61% negative and 39% positive after Trump defeated his last Republican rivals, with the most recent Real Clear Politics poll average showing Hillary Clinton at 45.3 points to Donald Trump at 42.7 points, your broadcast news networks, who utilize federal spectrum to conduct their operations. Think about that for just 1 second. He's saying that the government owns the electromagnetic spectrum. That is communism. Cyber communism, if you will. Who utilize federal spectrum to conduct their operations have a moral obligation to provide balanced, unbiased news coverage for the American people. The government's not in the business of enforcing moral obligations. If you're going to concede the legitimacy of government, the only moral obligations that the government can enforce have to do with refraining from using force or fraud at the expense of somebody else's rights. Not to dictate their conduct with respect to the expression of opinions. That's something that is explicitly foreclosed to the federal government, obviously, by the First Amendment, which is something that Kevin Cramer, who had aspired to be a Lutheran pastor at one point, apparently doesn't understand. To be clear, he continues, I do not support a return to the fairness doctrine. No, but he embraces its premises. I'm not sure, and this is something I should investigate, but I would suspect that Kevin Cramer is among those who consider themselves to be persecuted, perhaps rightly so, by the IRS investigating the political activities of partisan political action groups. He's threatening to use the regulatory power of government to do exactly the same thing with respect to media organs that have expressed views that he considers to be biased. To be clear, I do not support a return to the fairness doctrine. However, and any time you use that conjunction, it nullifies whatever preceded it. However, while the principle of an independent media is critical to our constitutional government, a news media free of political bias is required for a free system to flourish, and that is entirely demonstrably false. The press at the time that the First Amendment was written, in the decades leading up to it, in the decades thereafter, was intensely, pervasively partisan. Let a thousand flowers bloom, let a thousand opinions flourish. The First Amendment expresses the view of John Milton's Areopagitica. Let truth and error freely contend in the serene confidence that truth will prevail. The difference, I suppose, is that John Milton was actually a Christian who believed in freedom, unlike Kevin Cramer. Our national broadcast networks, our national broadcast networks have a unique relationship with the American people, one that should not be taken lightly and has been supported by our federal government from the very beginning. Still today, broadcast networks who enjoy the use of federally allocated spectrum to increase their access to the American people. For this reason, I am alarmed by recent polls and studies which seem to confirm that our national network news has devolved from fact-based journalism to surreptitious propaganda. It's so surreptitious, Kevin, that the public realizes they're being propagandized, and they filter out what is obviously biased and unreliable. But once again, take note of the way he uses the collective possessive pronoun, our, as allocated by our federal government. The claim of collective ownership is woven through this ignorant letter. As you are well aware, and here, Kevin Cramer gets down to the business of redefining an innate right as a government-issued privilege. As you are well aware, the privilege to broadcast a free signal is a privilege afforded to very few, and with it comes tremendous responsibility. The broadcast license awarded to you by the Federal Communications Commission is on behalf of the citizens. The spectrum your news is carried on is not yours alone, but rather the property of a skeptical citizenry, and I once again underscore the fact that the public is skeptical, that the audience, that the marketplace is composed of people who have the capacity to evaluate and criticize what they are being told. Especially now that there is such an antic proliferation of alternative news sites, that the legacy news media, the gatekeeping media, has been overwhelmed and outflanked. Your FCC license and the liberty that comes with your First Amendment rights are not a license to broadcast anything you want or in any way you choose. Rather, this special freedom comes with basic moral and legal parameters, wrote Kevin Kramer, somebody who doesn't know anything about the First Amendment, but whose instincts are those of a right Leninist. This is important in light of the fact that Donald Trump is the most litigious person ever to be elected to the presidency. He has sued promiscuously. Every time somebody has said something in public that offended him, somebody who had a significant media platform, he has threatened to sue, and often sued people in ways that are purely intended for the purpose of harassment. And he has threatened that as president, he would, quote, open up our libel laws in order to sue the media for its negative coverage. That's the tone and temperament that is going to characterize the Trumpian Republican Party in an era of unified Republican government. I'll return in just a few minutes.
I'll tell you what. I think the media is among the most dishonest groups of people I've ever met. And believe me, if I become president, oh, do they have problems. They're going to have such problems. And one of the things I'm going to do, and this is only going to make it tougher for me, and I've never said this before, but one of the things I'm going to do if I win, and I hope I do, and we're certainly leading, is I'm going to open up our libel laws so when they write purposely negative and horrible and false articles, we can sue them and win lots of money. We're going to open up those libel laws.
Percent of evangelicals voted for Donald Trump. 16% voted for Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
You got it dead right.
You know, I was in Trump's office yesterday afternoon. He asked me, how is the vote going to be for evangelicals? I said, oh, it's going to be strong. I'm sure glad it turned out that
when
way.
When you said that to him, what did he say to you?
He was very pleased by it. He thought it would be as well. And I think what this reveals, Stuart, is there was that hidden evangelical vote, people not wanting to admit they were voting for Trump. A producer last night here at Fox said to me that her mother was in a Sunday school class, and the mother finally confessed to the class, I'm voting for Trump. All the other women started laughing, said, we are too, but we're afraid to tell anybody.
But the bottom line is surely that the evangelicals voted against Hillary Clinton.
Commenting on Tuesday's presidential election, Reverend Franklin Graham said the media and political pundits do not understand what happened because they do not understand the God factor, the power of prayer, and added that God intervened on November 8th to stop the godless, atheistic, progressive agenda from taking control of our country, reports CNS News. This would mean, apparently, that the resolutely irreligious, twice divorced, irrepressibly promiscuous, self-indulgently materialistic mogul who is now the president-elect embodies the worthy aspirations of the pious. In a November 10th post on Facebook, continues CNS News, Reverend Graham wrote, did God show up? In watching the news after the election, the secular media keep asking, how did this happen? What went wrong? How did we miss this? Some are in shock. Political pundits are stunned. Many thought the Trump-Pence ticket didn't have a chance. None of them understand the God factor. Hundreds of thousands of Christians from across the United States have been praying, he continued. This year they came out to every state capital to pray for this election and for the future of America. Prayer groups were started, families prayed, churches prayed, then Christians went to the polls, and They displayed that they don't understand the difference between faith and gullibility is the proper way to finish that sentence. However, the way that Graham finished it was God showed up. While the media scratches their heads and tries to understand how this happened, I believe that God's hand intervened Tuesday night to stop the godless, atheistic, progressive agenda from taking control of our country. Which means that it would be a species of blasphemy, one would assume, to oppose Donald Trump, who, for all of his spectacular flaws, is the vessel of the divine will, supposedly. Just a week before he was elected, this divinely anointed political savior made a campaign stop in Greeley, Colorado, where he became the first Republican nominee to hold aloft the rainbow banner of the LGBT revolution. That revolution, I hasten to specify, is not about protecting the individual liberties of sexual minorities, but rather about using the power of the state to reconfigure society on behalf of them as a collective interest group. The rainbow flag that he was handed by a gay activist named Max Nowak contained the inscription LGBTs for Trump. Trump unfurled it and then, smiling, walked across the stage with the rainbow banner to show others, reported the Christian News. Last June at a fundraiser, Trump had told donors that he is the best presidential candidate to represent the interests of the gay community. During his acceptance speech at the Cleveland Convention, and this is something that is already forgotten, I think, Trump promised that, quote, as president, I will do everything in my power to protect LGBTQ citizens from the violence and oppression of a hateful foreign ideology. That was a very artfully wrought applause line that manipulated conservatives in the auditorium and across the country watching on television to cheer on behalf of the gay rights revolution by invoking a common enemy, which is Islamic extremism. After the convention crowd performed on cue, Trump declared, I have to say, as a Republican, it is so nice to hear you cheering what I just said. That applause, from my perspective, didn't reflect concern for sexual minorities as individuals, that is, people each of whom is made in the image of the Creator and invested with property rights, including the right to be free of aggressive violence. I think it was actually a reflection of the fact that they were seen as a politically exploitable constituency, and that this applause was a specimen of what the alt-right would usually call virtue signaling, which in this case, I guess, was considered acceptable because it was in the service of their divine God Emperor Trump. What I do find most remarkable here, though, is the fact that this was seen by the evangelical leaders as something to celebrate rather than something that was troublesome. And I think this underscores the fact that whatever their denominational labels, they belong to a different sect within the larger religion we could call statism. Stephen Turley, writing at the Imaginative Conservative, seems to perceive Donald Trump as a vindicator of the Christian faithful. It is the waning of this secular vision of life that is perhaps the most significant indicator of Mr. Trump's win, he says. We are now entering into what scholars call a post-secular society age. As the name implies, a post-secular society is one that no longer subscribes to the two fundamental commitments of secularism, scientific rationalism and personal autonomy or lifestyle values. Personal autonomy, bear that in mind. At a very basic level, post-secular society is about the return of religion and religious values in the public square. We've seen this with the advent of Sharia councils in the UK that arbitrate between conflicts among Muslims, the resurgence of the Russian Orthodox Church as a major political, moral, and cultural force in the Russian Federation, and revival of imperial Shintoism at the highest levels of the Japanese government, a revitalization of Confucian philosophy among Chinese officials, Hindu nationalism in India, Islam in Turkey, and on and on. All of these developments, I hasten to point out, involve the fusion of a politicized version of a traditional faith or a faith philosophy, I think that the best description of Confucianism is faith philosophy, with the national state. Here in the U.S., continues Turley, similar processes are evident in the increasing collapse of multiculturalism and political correctness, which together represent the value system of secularization. I would refer to them as a species of political religion, but that's a matter of nuance, one supposes. Multiculturalism is the idea that America is made up of a plurality of cultural identities that consumer-defined individuals get to pick for themselves, with no single culture being dominant or superior. And political correctness is simply multiculturalism married to the state, wherein government policies favor some cultural or ethnic groups at the expense of others. Hence, Van Jones, on the night of Mr. Trump's victory, could spout on CNN that white people voting their interests is racist and nativist bigotry, while black people voting their interests is liberation and justice. Van Jones, of course, is a communist. He believes in the who-whom dichotomy. We can see evidence of a revitalized civic religion here at home, Turley continues. In his recent campaign speech in Maine, Mr. Trump said, "Imagine what our country could accomplish if we started working together as one people under God, saluting one American flag." This became a refrain in his campaign speeches, "One people under one God." And while some can't get past the potential threat to religious freedom such a hypothetical statement represents, parenthetically, I think the real threat to religious freedom here is the fact that Donald Trump seems to believe that the federal government should maintain a registry of houses of worship within one specific faith community, namely the Muslims. That's one of the reasons why so many warbot evangelicals gave him unqualified support. We have to understand that this is precisely the kind of revitalization of public religion that accompanies the ascendancy of nationalist sentiments, Turley points out. Thus, it appears that the waning of multiculturalism and the rise of a nationalist populism indicates the dawn of a post-secular age. Despite the sporadic protests to the contrary, a Trump presidency signals to the wider culture that it is now open season on political correctness, and as far as I'm concerned, it couldn't have come soon enough. Rod Dreher of the American Conservative, who is a faithful Christian and one of the most perspicuous critics of politicized religion, asks exactly the right question. Where exactly is this evidence of revival? If Hillary Clinton had won, as she nearly did, conservative Christians would be decrying the secularization of post-Christian America. It's a question of which faction controls the instrumentality of violence. The surprise victory of a thrice-married Republican candidate who brags about grabbing women by their genitals and says he doesn't need to be forgiven by God for anything, this heralds a new Christian dawn? Here in this post is the temptation the church faces in the Trump era, concludes Dreher. Embracing a weaponized Eisenhower-era civil religion masquerading as Christianity, because that worked so well for us in the 1980s, Dreher Riley concludes. It is vitally important to recognize that Donald Trump doesn't actually build things. He puts his name on structures that are built by other people, and in this case, he's rebranding Obama's police state apparatus, which Trump's adherents are eager to expand in the deluded belief that they will always control it. Never forget that you are helping to build or helping to expand something that will be inherited by your political enemies. That being the case, wouldn't demolition be a more useful and worthy investment of your time? Thank you for joining me this week on Freedom Zealot Radio. Please join me online at thelibertarianinstitute.org and freedominourtime.blogspot.com. I will be back with you again in a week. And until then, as always, doom spiro pugno, while I breathe, I fight. Good night, God bless, and may we send the state back to the hell that spawned it.
What do you want to do now, Cap?
The same thing we always do. Fight them until we can't.